What's going on, everybody? Welcome back to the show. Today's going to be a Q&A episode. Thank you to everybody who asked a question. I'm trying to do these a couple times a week now, but keep them on the shorter side. Let's see how that goes. I have a couple solo episodes, a couple good guests coming up in the next month or two. Podcast is something I do want to lean a little bit more into. Instagram's been super fun, but I do think some of this long-form content is really nice. And so we're going to do that. So let's jump right into today's episode. First question is, will this menopause stomach ever go away? I've been with you for a long time, and let me just say I love your program and your take on just about everything. Thank you. I don't even know if like air quote menopause stomach is like a thing out there in the Insta sphere, but there's all this like cortisol belly and menopause belly and kind of these things that get coined as terms that are really just kind of marketing tools to kind of prey on, you know, just fear-mongery stuff here. But in any case, let's talk about the facts. The facts are that between 20 and 60, age 20 to 60, metabolism doesn't really slow down. And so this idea that, oh, you turn 40 or, oh, you turn 50 or, oh, I went, you know, by the way, I want to say this with the most sympathy. I don't like the way that that was about to come out. But like your metabolism isn't slowing down during this time to a degree in which weight gain is inevitable from a physiological perspective. Going through menopause, perimenopause can bring about symptoms that make body composition, maintenance, and changes in terms of fat loss more challenging. Namely, you know, poor sleep, changes in mood, energy levels, all that stuff, totally real, absolutely real. And they can make all of this a lot harder. And another real thing is that, you know, going through menopause, changes in hormones, can cause or likely will cause some amount of fat redistribution. So the where you store fat can change. And a lot of times what's happening is its weight can come from thighs and hips and end up in the belly area based on these hormonal changes. And that is normal. So when you say, you know, will this menopause stomach ever go away? You know, is it fat redistribution stuff? In many cases, I put that in the normal bucket, not necessarily something that you need to be, you know, doing something about per se, that, you know, somebody might be screaming at the, you know, at their phone right now saying, oh, do HRT, HRT can fix that. Like maybe, I don't even like the word fix. I mean, I would not, you know, hormone replacement therapy is not to fix that. Let's be clear. It's to improve symptoms of perimenopause to increase quality of life. It's not, oh, I want to redistribute some fat, you know? And so that's absolutely a real thing. You know, again, whether you should specifically do something about that, the hormonal side of things is up to you and your endocrinologist, your doctor, your OB. If it's like a fat gain, like a fat accumulation thing, then yeah, I think I would find it to be a good thing for someone to tell me, hey, your metabolism is not slower. You kind of got to look at the ins and outs of calories. You got to look at your movement. You got to look at your diet, your lifestyle, and see if that has changed. Because if the truth is the game is the same. You're playing the same game with the same rules. And yeah, it's a more difficult level, but the rules are the same. And so, yeah, so it depends on what you necessarily mean by menopause stomach, but I do want to kind of normalize. One, life can be much harder during this time from a wide range of symptoms that make it so, and also that there is a normal fat redistribution that can happen during this time from hormonal changes. And yeah, whether you need to do something about that or not, I think the first step is kind of normalizing it. Next question. What would be a sample week of meeting the physical activity guidelines? So the physical activity guidelines are 150 minutes of moderate physical activity per week. So like cardiovascular exercise, 150 minutes of moderate cardiovascular exercise, or 75 minutes of vigorous cardiovascular exercise, or some combination of the two, and 2 days of resistance training. So 2 days of resistance training is pretty straightforward. 2 days of lifting, and doing that for, let's say, 30 to 60 minutes, you know, meeting all of the basic boxes that you want to check. You know, taking sets close to failure, compound lifts are good, you know, a mix of machines and free weights, all that good stuff. We don't need to go too deep into that. As far as 150 minutes, I think people get caught up with the vigorous versus moderate. Like, what is moderate? Moderate, I'd say, is, you know, and I'll say this in a specific way and we'll talk more generally. I'd say moderate is anything above zone one. So if you're walking your dog at like a very slow, like, pace where you're just not at all challenged cardiovascularly whatsoever, I wouldn't count that towards your physical activity guidelines. Do I think walking is exercise? Absolutely. Do I think people should walk more? Absolutely. Is walking just about the most easily accessible, amazing thing you can do for your health? Definitely. But is it really checking the box of like challenging cardiovascular work? No, it's checking other boxes though. So I don't want to poo-poo walking. Walking's awesome. But if you're looking to meet the physical activity guidelines for overall health from an exercise standpoint, I'd say anything above that. So anything from, let's say, a really brisk walk or above would probably count towards this. If you're doing, you know, if you're someone who's more into the weeds of like what zone two is, I would say zone two is that moderate. So for a lot of people, an incline walk at, let's say, 3 miles per hour and somewhere between 5 and 10 incline would meet that kind of moderate physical activity, keeping your heart rate, let's say, 70% of max heart rate, roughly. For a lot of people, that's going to be somewhere between like 125 and 145. I'd say that would be, you know, going for a hike that's not too challenging, a brisk walk, an incline walk, something like that is going to kind of check that moderate physical activity guideline. And so 150 minutes of that might be, you know, 3 50-minute zone two sessions. It might be, you know, going for a brisk walk. And that might sound like a lot for people, but you might find that you can check these boxes. Like you can do some of the vigorous as well, and that can kind of chip away at that 150-minute mark. And so maybe you do 2 days of zone two work, or you do a more brisk walk with the dog, or you go for a little bit of a challenge, you know, whatever, something a little bit more challenging, like a trail or something. You do a zone 2 day, and then you do some sort of like run walk, or again, when I say run walk, you don't need to run. I mean, some sort of higher intensity interval training. Higher intensity interval training, by the way, not necessarily high intensity interval training, but higher than just a brisk walk, where you're doing some sort of air quote run walk. It could be on a bike, could be on a rower, could be on a Stairmaster, elliptical, whatever, but something where you're getting your heart rate up a little bit more, right? It could be playing sports. It could be doing some of this interval training. It could be the, you know, the proverbial, like just go out for a run, depending on how fit you are. That might be practical, might not be practical. And so a sample week meeting physical activity guidelines might be something like Monday, you do 45 minutes zone two, Tuesday, you do a lift, Wednesday, you do maybe like a 25 minute interval session where you're accumulating, you know, let's say 30 minute interval session where you're accumulating like 10 minutes of hard work. So 10 minutes of work, 20 minutes of walking, some sort of interval structure. Then where are we? We're on Thursday, we're lifting again. And then Friday, maybe another zone two. And then on the weekend, you go for a brisk walk. And I don't know if that sounds like a lot for people. I don't know. But I kind of want to normalize that. I mean, the physical, like, it's so funny. I'm already 7 minutes in and we're on question number two or something. But people crack me up. They're just like, this whole, like, there's just all this rhetoric about, like, the government wants to keep you sick. And they want, big pharma wants to keep, and the CDC want to keep you sick. And then, like, and then the CDC come out with a guideline like this, which I think is incredible. It's an incredible guideline. Like, if people are like, where should I start with exercise? It's like the CDC physical activity guidelines. They are incredible. They're amazing. Do this. 150 minutes, low, you know, moderate intensity cardio per week, 2 days of strength training, or, you know, mixing in some of that vigorous activity. Like, amazing. Like, they don't want to keep you sick. They have this incredible guideline to help you be healthy. Like, it's an amazing thing to shoot for. I don't think that that physical activity guideline is a minimum effective dose, by the way. I don't think that you should look at that as like, oh, that's the minimum I should be doing. That's a really, really great amount of work. That's certainly not something where if you're doing a little less than that, you're not getting benefit. This is not some minimum effective dose. That is a, like, really nice thing to shoot for getting a high percentage of the health benefits of exercise. So I don't want you to, if you heard that, you're like, well, I can't do that much. That doesn't mean you shouldn't do what you can. And it doesn't mean if you do what you can, even, you know, albeit a little bit less, that you wouldn't be getting a ton of benefit. You absolutely would. Oh my God, yes. That is not a minimum effective dose. That is like, it's not a maximal effective dose. You know, that's not the absolute maximum you can benefit from exercise. But damn, that is a good, really good week. And I'll tell you right now, with my parents who are, you know, looking to talk about aging, you know, looking to age more, I was going to say gracefully, fuck that. I hate that terminology. What I mean is like age more, I was going to say youthfully. That's not what I mean. I mean, physically robust. We have had chats about this exact physical activity guideline. So I think it's fantastic. Next question. Does lowering body fat percentage always improve health, even if you are already within a healthy range? No. Like the truth is, like, if that were the case, then, you know, being bodybuilding stage lean would be the healthiest people can be. And that is absolutely not the case. So losing body fat does not always meaningfully improve health. Anything else I want to say on that? It's not clear exactly where that line is, by the way, guys. But the truth is, if we look at body fat percentages and all-cause mortality, you know what? I'm sitting at my computer. I'm going to look it up right now. I think for women, it's somewhere around 27% body fat. And that's where we see the best. So optimal body fat percentage for women. So I'm not going to go too deep into this, but body fat percentage average between 20 and 30% for women. Best body fat percentages average between 12 and 20% for men and 20 and 30% for women. And so, and again, there are a lot of studies that have looked at this. Yes. So long-term well-designed studies, the lowest morbidity and mortality rates occurred in adults at weights that yielded a BMI between, let's say, 20 and 25. And so it does not seem that going below that or going from the high end of that to the low end of that is clearly going to make you healthier. And so I think, again, BMI, people have their own issues. BMI is an amazing tool at a population level. It's not an amazing tool on an individual level. It certainly is not. And so I think the answer to your question is no. I do not think lowering body fat percentage always improves your health. If you're already a healthy person and you already have, if you were like, this is tricky where it comes with this like health at every size. Like if somebody has obesity and they have a lot of excess body fat, but their blood work checks out as a currently healthy person, I still think that they are more likely to, over the long term, see negative health impacts from having excess body fat. And so even for like that person, I would bet that losing body fat over the long term has an impact. But if you're like objectively looking at your BMI body fat percentage, they're kind of scoring in this 20 to 30% for women, 12 to 20% for men, body fat range, you're in a normal BMI range, your blood work all checks out. I don't think I'd be sitting there saying, yeah, weight loss is going to make you healthier. I don't think that that is a position I would take. Next question. Can you build significant muscle while pregnant since you eat in a surplus during pregnancy? I've heard conflicting things. You can. I mean, the word is significant. I got to tell you, I'm lost on the question a little bit because I just don't think this is the thing you should be focusing on right now. And I don't mean to kind of disentangle that from the question because you could be in a person who's not focused on that, but still asking this as a question. You can. I have seen some things that have shown a decreased rate of muscle gain just because of the prioritization of nutrients elsewhere, which makes a ton of sense. And so I have heard that as well. And if those are some of the things you've heard as far as conflicting things, I would say, if you took out the word significant, can you build muscle while pregnant because you're eating in a surplus and you could be lifting? Yes. I think the answer is absolutely yes. Significant is a subjective word. Would I say, can you build, the same size surplus being pregnant versus not being pregnant? Would you build more muscle not being pregnant? I'd bet absolutely yes. I'd have to dive a little bit deeper into that research. But from what I've heard, there is a decreased rate, let's say, of muscle protein synthesis, a redistribution of nutrients elsewhere for more important things, which is objectively true, more important things. But yeah, if you're pregnant, you can still build muscle. It's just not, I cringe even saying that because it's just not the point. It's not the point. The point of the exercise for you right now is mental health, your physical health, baby's physical health, and there's so much good research that shows that this is something that is good for you, good for baby. And so, yeah, that would be, I hope, your primary source of motivation during this time. If the idea of still being able to build some muscle during this time keeps you motivated to keep doing that, then that's great. I think you can absolutely do that, but especially as we're entering late second, early third, obviously late term pregnancy. I don't think that idea of I got to PR, I got to push maximum progression, I got to build as much muscle. I don't know if that should be on your mind. It should be more about not all the way on the other end of the spectrum of just going through the motions, but certainly not, a crazy F ton of heavy compound lifts, mega close to failure. It might not be where my head would be at. All right, next question. What volume do you need to be lifting at to maintain rather than grow muscle mass? Rough percentage. I know you'll probably say it depends. Yeah, there are studies that show you could maintain on 1/9 the amount of volume that you were using to grow muscle. But that's the only helpful thing from that because of, like you said, I will probably say it depends. There's so much context of like what you were doing before, you know, how close to failure you were training, what exercises you were doing, who you are, how close to your genetic ceiling you are, how much body fat you have, you know, all of that stuff matters a ton. So when someone's like, oh, I can, you know, survive, you know, I can maintain with one, like up to 1/9. Let me make sure that's the, I think it is maintaining muscle with 1/9. So that has been seen. Relatively low training volume, 1/9 of the volume is enough to maintain muscle size and strength gains from a high volume training program for young adults. So that already tells me, it was 1/9 of the volume from, let's say, a high volume training program. So again, 1/9 of a high volume training program, maybe you're doing a little bit lower volume. I'd say my program is probably in the moderate volume. We're not, again, we're training 4 days a week with moderate volume, a little bit higher intensity. And so if you just took our total set numbers, I would not 1/9 them if your goal was to maintain. You're on a more moderate size, moderate volume program. Maybe you can get by with half the amount of volume. So when the statistics are out there that say, oh, you can maintain with 1/9 the amount of sets, what I would take from that is not a specific multiplier for you to use with your program, but I would find some solace, some peace of mind in just hearing that, knowing that it's actually quite low. It's quite low. And the more research that we have done over the last decade, the lower that bar goes, all the way to this like 1/9 number. And so it depends on what you're doing, depends on how hard you train. You know, the lower you go with your volume, the more I would train close to failure, all the way to failure, beyond failure, partials, intensity techniques, just to make sure I'm getting the stimulus I need from a reduced amount of time. And so it depends. I think if you're on a moderate training plan, you could probably half the amount of volume. And if you kept intensity training close to failure, if you kept that high, that you'd be very happy with the results. If you're training on a mega high volume training program, 6 days a week, you know, 20 sets per muscle group per week, whatever, you could probably get by with, a 1/9, a quarter, a third, you know, you'd be able to decrease. The more you're doing, the more relative decrease you could have, I guess you could say. And so, yeah, depends what you're doing. Like you said, ton of it depends moments. But I think the thing I would take home is you can maintain on a lot less than it takes to grow. That is true for everyone. So you can maintain your muscle on a lot less than it took you to grow it. But it depends on, you know, the percent decrease depends on currently what you're doing, of course. Next question. Are forearm grip squeezes working the flexors or the extensors of the forearm? A little bit of both. Absolutely a little bit of both. I don't know in what context you would do this, though. You could, you know, does that improve grip strength? If you get one of those like little, I don't even remember what they're called. They're like those little like handles with like the metal coil where you're squeezing it. It's also going to work a lot of the finger muscles, hand muscles, and definitely some of the forearms, probably more the flexors. But you're actually not doing a lot of like flexing and extending. So a little bit more of those finger and hand muscles, but not really sure what context I would recommend somebody do this. Maybe if you're a rock climber or something like that, or you are a raw lifter or something and you absolutely can't use straps for some reason. You know, what I always get triggered with forearm grip, like work questions, because I think people hear a statistic about, you know, grip strength is one of the greatest correlators with healthy aging. It's like, yeah, that's true because people who are older with good grip, it's a proxy for physical activity over the lifespan. It's not that your grip is making you live longer. It's that old dudes and chicks who have health, who have strong grips are the same people who probably did more physical activity over their lifespan. So, cool. Next question. When not enough space to do walking lunges, 10 to 12 per leg, is it okay to do alternating lunges instead? Or is there something unique about walking lunges? So the answer is yes and yes. Is there something unique about walking lunges? Absolutely. There's a forward propulsion between reps. There's the there's like the eccentric kind of resisting the deceleration component of landing on that front leg as you are moving forward. But, you know, how much does that matter? Does it matter so much that you should relocate your workout in order to do them? No, absolutely not. If I put walking lunges in my program, you will see in the notes, hey, if you can't at least do like 6 walking lunges in, you know, before having to turn around, then I would forego whatever unique benefit there is to walking lunges, and I would trade them for alternating lunges. And I would probably trade them for alternating reverse lunges. And frankly, I might even forego the alternating component and just switch to a walking lunge where you're, or sorry, reverse lunge where you do all the reps on one leg before switching to the other leg. Like, that is probably what I would recommend. You could do alternating lunges, alternating reverse lunges in place, or you could just say, hey, I'm going to do all on my right leg, then I'm going to rest, then all on my left leg. I think that those would both work fine. So yeah, there's something unique about walking lunges from the forward propulsion and the deceleration when you land, but yeah, I don't think it's a big deal and I wouldn't lose a wink of sleep. Next question. Client feels seated leg curl in their pelvic floor and isn't able to give me video feedback. Not really sure what could be going on. Thigh pad not sitting tight enough. Any suggestions? Oof. I mean, yeah, video feedback is by far the single... I'll say a couple things. Number one, video feedback is super important. The seated leg curl, a lot of people either put it too heavy or don't create enough stability by pushing into the handles where they're pushing their lower back into the pad, or people who like to lean forward aren't finding a comfortable position. Like, I've seen some pretty crappy seated leg curl technique, and it's not even like a technique thing, it's just a machine, but you might be set up inappropriately. Your knee might not be in line with the axis of the machine. You know, the seat might be too far forward or too far back. You might not be doing enough work to create that stability, to keep your pelvis, to keep your butt kind of wedged in the corner where the seat meets the backrest. So yeah, you know, like you said, the thigh pad might not be sitting tight enough. I put that thigh pad as tight as I possibly comfortably can. And so yeah, video feedback is number one. I'm not being rude here. I'm not sure what would make somebody not able to give video feedback. I can see why somebody might not. Like, I can sympathize to some degree with people who don't love taking videos of themselves, but this would be a moment where it's like, hey, like, you have discomfort on this thing. Like, it's probably worth overcoming that fear of taking a video to get me that information so you can do this without pain. Maybe your gym doesn't allow videos. I think that's so stupid. I mean, I get why people do that, but I don't think it's stupid, because I think that what you get by not letting your gym take videos is you eliminate the, like, influencers with the tripod who film their whole workout and get mad that people walk in front of their camera. Yeah, I hate that stuff. But, like, you know, just like an average person taking a form video because they want to make sure they're doing it right so they can send it to their coach. Like, I'm sad for that person. So I'm not really sure what specific suggestions I would have without seeing the form video. But yeah, I would look at thigh pad. I would look at, you know, is there a knee joint lining up with the axis of the machine? Is the backrest and the backrest being too far forward or too far back would implicate that, would change kind of where their knee is lining up. Are they not creating enough stability with their hands? Are they not trying to keep their back? Is the weight too heavy? All that stuff. Next question. I'm switching to maintenance. If I don't track and eat enough protein, will I lose muscle even if I maintain my workouts? No. Let's say you actually eat maintenance calories. You said, if I don't track. Oh, sorry. If you don't track and thus that leads to not eating enough protein, will you lose muscle? Absolutely not. No chance. If you're at maintenance calories, dude, if you're at maintenance calories and you're lifting weights hard, heavy enough to, you know, enough of a stimulus that's really pronounced, you're going to gain muscle. You will, even with lower protein. This idea that, like, you need a lot of protein to build muscle is not true. You need a lot, you know, a high amount of protein to build maximum amount of muscle, but the training stimulus and your calories are way more important than eating a super high amount of protein. Being at, you know, imagine you asked me who builds more muscle, person in a deficit eating a lot of protein, training hard, or person at maintenance eating less protein and training hard? The person at maintenance, a bajillion percent more. A bajillion might not be evidence-based percentage there, but significantly more. You know, long story short, I bet on that person for sure. So no. Can you go over the line of force on machines like hack squat? Can you go over the line of force on a leg press pendulum? So can you go over the line of force on machines like hack squat, leg press pendulum? So the line of force for those machines will just be the angle of the track that the machine moves on. That's it. So if you look at a leg press, it's usually on a 45 degree angle and the machine moves linearly, right? Linearly. There's no arc to a leg press unless you're talking about a Cybex squat press that does kind of move a little bit on an arc. I love the Cybex squat press. It's amazing. If you have one, use it. But if you just look at a leg press and a hack squat, they're usually on roughly a 45 degree angle and it is a linear track, meaning that the carriage, the thing that you're moving, if you're in a hack squat, it's the part with the shoulder pads. If you're at the leg press, it's the part that you're pushing up into. It's just moving linearly on that track. So that is the line of force. The line of force is where the force is coming from. If you're doing, you know, free weight exercises and stuff like that, it's gravity. If you're doing cable exercises, it's the angle of where the cable is coming from in relation to, you know, the limb that is moving it. With a pendulum, however, it's not on a linear track. It is an arcing motion. Meaning at the top, the pendulum, let's say, is pointed horizontally, and as it goes down, it's moving about an axis point, and so it arcs from a more vertical path at the beginning to a more horizontal path towards the bottom. And because of that, it can be quite challenging, and you can build a lot of momentum in the pendulum, so I highly recommend that you go a little bit slower towards the end. It's very easy to pick up speed on the pendulum if you aren't paying attention to the eccentric tempo. So anything else on the line of force with machines like hacksaw, leg press, pendulum? Yeah, so that is the line of force for those machines. It's just the track, the angle of the track that the machine is moving on, where it's linear on a 45-ish degree angle for the hack and the leg press, and the pendulum kind of moves, again, like a pendulum, about an axis point where you begin the movement traveling more downward, and you finish the movement traveling more kind of inward on a horizontal line of force. Next question. What other programs do you recommend? What other programs? Beside yours, of course. Just curious what others are similar. Yeah, a couple of people have asked me this. There are a lot. Ruth Empower has a good one. Ruth and I are good friends. Ruth, you're in good hands. And let me just say, like, I will say two things, actually. I like my program the best. And there are a ton of programs that will get you good results, and you are in good hands. So I work really hard to make my program what I think is the best of the best of the best. But every program I list right now, if you were like, nah, Jordan, I'm going to do that program, you would A, have my blessing, not that you need it, but I would feel like, yeah, like I would send my mother to those programs. I would send my friends to those programs because they are really well done by intelligent people who work hard at them, and you're in good hands. So there's off the top of my head, by the way, I'm going to forget people. Paragon is really great. My friend Brian Borstein does all the programming. Brian's mega smart. You're in good hands. Ruth has a program. Lifting Lindsay has a program. Alex Thiem has a program. A lot of us use the Train Heroic app. I think that they are all fantastic. And you're in good hands. You know, when I say you're in good hands, what I mean is you're going to be with somebody who cares, who really works hard, not necessarily, oh, they do this fancy evidence-based programming. Yes, they're up to speed in terms of biomechanics. They're up to speed in terms of, you know, good exercise selection for hypertrophy. But I know that these people care. I know that they will work hard. I know that they put effort in. Because I'll tell you right now, there are so many group programs that I've joined that are just freaking throwaways. There are people who have hundreds of thousands of followers who think, oh, I'll make a group program. I won't work hard at it, and I'm not, it might sound like I'm bitter about this, but I'm just telling it how it is, that I've joined a million group programs just to see what else is out there, and there are people that are like, hey, this group program thing is a really scalable opportunity for me to capitalize on my hundreds of thousands of followers. Let me just fling something together that, you know, a couple thousand people might join, but, you know, a bunch of people are going to realize that it's kind of crap, but, you know, I can make some easy money here. Brianna Ray Fitness is also another good one. I'm just trying to, people are just popping into my mind that have group programs. And so, yeah, the difference for me is people who put work into it that have additional content attached to their group program that offer additional resources in addition to their group program, not necessarily people that are just like, oh, I have, you know, a lot of hundreds of thousands of followers. Here's a program that just says 3x8x12, you know, back squats, and then you go on your way. And so, yeah, those are some others that are similar to mine, and you'd be in good hands with any of those people. Next question, is a push-pull legs program enough to make progress for an intermediate lifter? I like the format, but one lower day doesn't seem like enough, or is it? It can be. It absolutely can be. Listen, remember, total volume across the week is what matters most. So if you do a leg day that has like 5 exercises, 3 working sets each, you can build legs that way. Is it enough for you to build muscle as an intermediate lifter? Absolutely. Is that enough for a pro bodybuilder looking to maximize muscle growth over the lifespan? Probably not. And the less frequency you have, the maybe the longer the workouts kind of need to be to account for that, maybe a little bit closer to failure. But your question was, is it enough to make progress for an intermediate lifter? There's a couple subjective things there, like intermediate, you know, we don't really know what that means. I'm not picking on you for using that terminology. It's just like, it's a difficult thing to kind of nail down where that is. And progress is a little bit binary, but sometimes people don't think of it as binary. It's a subjective term of what they deem to be enough progress to be worthwhile. And I don't know that for you. I think in a binary sense, can somebody who's been lifting for a couple of years do a push-pull leg split of, let's say, 60 to 90 minute workouts and make progress in a binary sense, meaning build muscle at all? Yeah, definitely. I definitely think so. Remember, total volume across the week is what matters most. So if you did like 15 working sets on each day, 10 to 15 working sets each day, you worked really hard, close to failure, sometimes beyond failure. Yeah, I think you can build muscle, absolutely. Couple more, we got 30 minutes here. If you cut calories for a deficit by too much to start, will it force you to keep cutting too low? This is gonna be the last question because I'm gonna try not to rant on this. Okay, so let me start again. If you cut calories for a deficit by too much to start, will it force you to keep cutting too low down the line to be effective? Only seeing results when deficit is between 800 and 1,000. So I'm gonna forego a discussion about the numbers you just gave me because I think that begs a lot of questions about who you are, what size you're at, how sedentary you are, whether or not those numbers are accurate. I don't want to go down that route right now. So I'm going to just address the original question, which is if you cut calories by, if you start with a huge deficit, is that going to somehow make you have to go even lower in the future? Is your metabolism going to adapt even quicker? No. I want you guys to forget about all this crap that's out there. If you go into a large deficit to start, that will not make you adapt. People say shit like, if you go into a big deficit, your body will adapt and you'll have nowhere to go from there. That is complete and utter bullshit. You know what the biggest adaptation that you will make? Weight loss. A lot of weight loss. Like you will lose weight in proportion to the size of the deficit and your body will adapt in relation to the size of the deficit and the weight you lose. This kills me. If you go into a large deficit, you will lose a lot of weight very quickly. If you go into a small deficit, you will lose slower. And by the way, I'm not advocating anybody do either of those. I'm just saying it's all proportionate. There is no hacking it. If you cut calories by a lot, you're going to lose a lot of weight very quickly. If you cut calories more slowly, you lose weight more slowly. And obviously you're more comfortable that way. But there is no like, well, you're going to adapt to those calories quickly and then have nowhere to go. It's like, yeah, you know how you adapt mostly? By losing weight. Like, it kills me, man. And frankly, there's probably more rationale for doing a larger jump right from the start because you're starting in, I don't want to go down that route necessarily, but a person who's in a really good physiological place potentially has a little bit of excess body fat probably can handle a slightly larger deficit at the start and make more incremental changes down the road. But again, I wouldn't even go that route necessarily. I would have a conversation with a client about their lifestyle and what they've done in the past and all of that stuff before deciding on the deficit size. But you don't need to think about, oh, if I go into a big deficit, I'm going to be, you know, messing up my metabolism or I'm going to adapt too quickly and then have nowhere to go. Like, that just is flat out not a thing. How many more questions are even on this list? A lot. Oh boy. All right, whatever. What time is it? All right, we got a couple more. Next, how do you decide which exercises get two sets via three sets? I guess you're asking my group program. There's so much that goes into this question. There's the total length of the workout. There's the systemic fatigue of the exercise. There's the time it takes to set up. There's whether it's unilateral or not, what else you're doing on that day, what else you're doing across the week. And so, you know, I might look at a day of like three sets of RDL and then three sets of glute bridge, and then I want to put kind of a Bulgarian split squat. And I know that day, if I give three sets of Bulgarian split squats, a lot of people will be absolutely toasted by the time they finish two. And that third set is probably going to either emotionally be overly taxing or not get as good of an effort, or that workout's just going to be mega, mega, mega long and mega daunting. And so there's a lot that goes into that. I mean, it's like saying, you know, how do you decide how much ceviche to put in the second course of a 10-course meal. It's like, dude, like, you know, like, what else is in the ceviche dish? What else was in the first course or the third course or the seventh course? What are all the courses look like, right? Because there is a, it's relative to everything else you're doing. And for, when it comes to this sort of a discussion, it's what does the whole week look like? What does that day look like? What does that exercise look like? And that might play a factor in how many sets we are doing of that. Next, why are unilateral leg exercises so taxing on the cardiovascular system? I don't think they are any more taxing on the cardiovascular system than a bilateral, but you have to do two of them. You know, a set of Bulgarian split squats is, you know, first of all, taxing on the cardiovascular system is an interesting phrasing. I wouldn't say that. I'd say, you know, yeah, whatever. Let's not go deep into that. Let's just forget about that. I might rephrase that. But if you do a set of Bulgarian split squats, it's probably nearly as taxing. Well, it's actually probably not as taxing as a equally challenging set of bilateral back squats. If you take a Bulgarian split squat, like to, let's say, zero RIR, I bet you it's less cardiovascularly taxing than a bilateral back squat to the same level of intensity, just by nature of using more weight, more muscles. And so I think the taxing nature of unilateral work is mostly that you have to do two legs. I think the net huffy and puffy feeling, heart rate increase feeling of doing both legs of a Bulgarian split squat might net out to a greater feeling of exhaustion than one set of a bilateral back squat. Yeah, I think that that's a fair point, but I think that it's this mostly comes down to the unilateral nature of that exercise. What I mean is that you have to do both legs. Next question, a weird question, question after that. Most accurate, simple digital scale, preferably one without weight memories, having trouble finding one that doesn't stick to specific intervals of 1 pound. I have no idea what you mean. Weight memories, like, doesn't track your weight over time in an app? I'm not sure. I think they all, like, that's like the, that's thing, that's a feature that, like, most people want. Having trouble finding one that doesn't stick to specific intervals of 1 pound. You mean one that doesn't have decimal points? I really don't know. I'm not sure. Next question. What is the benefit of having higher calories on training days versus off days training during cut? Can you accomplish the same thing by keeping the calories the same across training and non-training days? How do you figure out the higher calorie days versus lower calorie days? So I'll tell you right now, this is called calorie cycling. Some people, you know, kind of rephrase calorie cycling as carb cycling because the macronutrient that you tend to shift to create a higher day tends to be addition of carbohydrate and lower day tends to be a reduction in carbohydrate, but it doesn't have to be that way. The truth is there is no benefit. There is only a perceived benefit. I'm serious. Just like if you eat 2000 calories every single day or you eat 2200 on training days and 1800 on rest days and you get to, let's say, roughly the same average calories across the week, it's going to be exactly the same. Unless you perceive there to be a benefit because maybe you feel hungrier on training days and less hungry on rest days. I personally speaking, I think it's, there are just as many people that get hungrier on rest days than there are people get hungrier on training days. And that can come from the fact that training can be an appetite suppressant, frankly. It's just a high stress activity that can sometimes blunt hunger. And so I would rather you, if you're going to cycle calories, have higher days, have lower days, it should reflect your hunger levels and your lifestyle. I would rather this be an appeal to hunger or an appeal to lifestyle, not a tool to get better results or anything like that. You'd have to be training, like, I think there's a small percentage of people who are at the elite level who are hyper-focused on acute performance during training that maybe can benefit from this, maybe. But that's a sliver of people, none of which are listening to this podcast, myself included. 99.99999%, you should be picking a calorie structure that you can adhere to, that helps you live your life, that allows you to have a lifestyle you like, that meets your kind of normal hunger regulation and fluctuations, not, I eat 200 more on my training day, so I get better gains. You don't. Let me just tell you, you don't. Like, you are recovering from that workout for like 4 days after training. Like, And so, like, if you think, oh, I had 200 extra calories on my training day, I got way better gains. Like, yeah, but the next day when you were still adapting to that training, that we still need muscle protein synthesis to be high, you had worse gains on that day, let's say. So it nets out to just, guys, averages over the week is what matters. You should, it should be an appeal to consistency, appeal to sustainability, not a little, these little fluctuations make me, you know, gain more or less muscle. All right, I'm going to call it there. I want to keep these short because I want to keep doing these a little bit more often. I think they're a lot of fun. And so I will see you guys in the next episode.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Where Optimal Meets Practical. If you liked the episode, it would mean the world to me if you posted a screenshot to your social media or left a 5-star review on iTunes. That stuff really helps. If you ever want to get in touch with me, just shoot me a DM on Instagram @JordanLipsFitness. I'm always around to chat. Thanks, guys. Have a good one.